ما حصل بعد 7 أكتوبر.
Dr. Wassam Nassif Yassin, thank you so much for joining us in this episode of Israel Watch. Until we meet again, God willing.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling he would say,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, it's a couple of episodes that we've actually decided to discuss some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, and we'd like to continue to do so. Well, let me start this episode with this question, Sheikh. Is it permissible for women to be among those who offer welcome or say welcome and offer flowers in the ceremonies held by the administrations and the like, justifying it as a demonstrating freedom and respect for women in Islamic societies?
Well, it does not make sense to invite women to participate in ceremonies like this, to just welcome foreigners, you know. And of course, if it leads to, you know, to some kind of vile consequence, or if it leads to promotion of un-Islamic culture, it's not permissible. And it's we should understand that demonstrating freedom and respect for women in such a way does not actually make sense. Of course, Islam does give tremendous importance to the status of women, and the Muslims are supposed to pay high regard to women. But this is now how, this is not the way Muslims should demonstrate freedom of women, mm-hmm. or respect for women. And such practices seem to be very much, you know, un-Islamic,
right?
In its true sense, yes. Because sometimes it might lead to some kind of shaking hands with foreigners. They may extend their hands, and then shaking hands is not permissible for mm-hmm. a woman with a non-mahram man.
But if they don't do so?
If they don't do so, again, they should not do so. But even if they don't extend their hands or maybe stretch their hands to shake hands, again, it's not okay to just to take women to the, for example, to the airport. And, you know, and let's say just give them a flower, and then the flower is given to someone coming from a foreign country. It doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm, I see. What's the view on wearing, actually, a necktie?
Well, generally speaking, it's not permissible to wear a tie or other kinds of clothes that are not considered as the attire of non, you know, that are considered to be, you know, I just want to correct myself. It is not permissible to wear a tie or any kinds of clothes that are considered as the attire of non-Muslims, okay? Like, for example, a clear example is the example of a necktie.
Mm-hmm.
I think there isn't any difference between a tie or a necktie because it's, okay, it's just a Christian symbol worn
yes.
by non-Muslims. Now, everywhere we see, whether they are Christians or Jews or anyone, they are non-Muslims and they wear this necktie, so it is not permissible to wear such clothes. And not to speak of the fact that also wearing such clothes might promote Western culture.
Mm. What about the bow?
The bow?
Yes.
I think I haven't seen any answer from His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, but based on the general fatwa, on the fatwa he's given, and just as I said, generally speaking, if an attire or a clothing, a piece of clothing is considered to be, you know, the attire of non-Muslims, it's not permissible to wear it.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take a break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, Ya Allah. Oh Allah, don't let me go astray, 'cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program, and Shah Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Shah Javid, what is the ruling in the matter of selling pictures, books, magazines that, you know, although not explicitly containing obscene materials, yet aimed implicitly to create an unsavory and un-Islamic cultural climate, especially among the youth?
Well, it's not permissible to sell, buy, and promote such material that aims to lead the youth astray, cause them depravity, you know, and create an immoral cultural climate. They should be avoided, and we do know that many of the magazines, as far as I know, contain, I think, adult pictures, you know, depraved content, which are not, you know, which is not in harmony with Islamic culture, with Islamic values. And of course, as you mentioned, they implicitly promote the Western culture, and it's not permissible to buy such clothes or to sell them and to promote such things which are considered to be Western.
Mm-hmm. And what's the duty or role of women nowadays in combating the cultural invasion of Islamic society?
The most important of women's duties is observing proper hijab.
Mm.
Hijab is a mandatory and a compulsory obligation which every adult woman, every woman must observe, regardless of the situation and the environment she lives in. And of course, it is also important for Muslim women to promote hijab through their action and to keep away from wearing that which reflects the norms of the enemy's culture. Okay, women should not wear, transparent and see-through clothes, tight clothes, which reveal the shape of their bodies, and which are considered the clothes of fame or libas-e-shohra. These clothes must not be worn neither by men nor by women. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Shafi. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad Hossein, this program, and our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid, and we are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Javid, in common with Christians, some Muslims celebrate Christmas. Is there a problem in that regard, according to the religious authorities and fatwas?
Well, there is no harm in celebrating the birthday of the Holy Jesus Christ. May peace be upon him and also upon our Prophet and his pure progeny. Mm. Muslims, generally speaking, consider Prophet Jesus as the Prophet, and they respect him. They give him respect, and the Muslims all over the world are unanimous in as to the fact that the Holy Prophet Jesus was a prophet. So there's no objection to celebrating his birthday. Mm. But it's also important to note that according to His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei and also religious authorities like Ayatollah Sistani have said that if a practice is considered to be confirmation and approval of their practices, of their belief system, and their, like, for example, they believe in Trinity, they believe in Jesus as God's Son, or such things. If a Muslim's behavior sends out a message like this, that he is confirming what they are doing and what they believe in, then it's not permissible. Mm-hmm. It's not permissible to confirm them in their behavior and their belief and their practices. Okay?
I see.
But as for when it comes to celebrating the birthday of the Holy Prophet Jesus, of course, there is no objection.
I see. Is it permissible to wear items of clothing bearing the advertisement of alcoholic drinks?
It is absolutely forbidden. It's not permissible for a Muslim to wear clothings which have such labels or such inscription inscriptions. And I think we have said in the past also in one of the previous episodes that it is degrading for a Muslim to wear clothes with a logo promoting a kind of alcoholic drink or a beverage which is intoxicating.
Absolutely forbidden.
And also it's absolutely forbidden.
Yes.
And the same is the case with anything which is forbidden, like gambling, like casinos, anything which is, or generally speaking, the Western culture, the Western values, which are hostile to Islamic values, there should not be anything on the clothing that you wear to promote Western culture and Western values.
I see. What about items of clothing that bear pictures of human beings or animals?
Of course, when it comes to wearing them, there is no objection in wearing those clothes per se. But it is to be noted that wearing clothes with pictures of animals and humans or any animated beings, okay, is makruh. During prayers,
I see.
It is reprehensible to wear a cloth with a human picture or with an animal, with the picture of an animal.
But what about plants?
Plants, there's no problem. There's no problem in having a picture of plants on your cloth. And also, the picture of an animal or a human being should not be anywhere in front of you. Okay, when praying. It is makruh according to all religious authorities.
Yes. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice contribution to this program, Islamic Laws on Iran Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, the host of this program, and my guest speaker, Sheikh Javid, and the rest of the crew, we bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Black and white.
Los pueblos, en su caminar, en la búsqueda de su bienestar.
Communities, in their quest for well-being and a government that truly places them at the center, and along this path, they sometimes make mistakes.
Algunas veces se equivoca y se equivoca mucho. Pero se equivoca no solamente porque tenga una...
Their missteps are not solely due to an inability to find the right path. Rather, they are influenced by various ideological, political, and economic factors that lead to mistakes. Some of these mistakes can be extremely harmful.
Terriblemente dañina. Argentina
has gone from mistake to mistake.
Tras equivocación. Pero lo que ha pasado.
But what has happened in this year of government of Javier Milei is impressive.
Loco Milei es impresionante. Tenemos que...
For instance, he has drastically reduced the number of ministries from 18 to just 8, significantly shrinking the government.
Sin embargo...
However, this has come at the cost of strengthening and nourishing the entire repressive apparatus.
Javier Milei ha expulsado.
Milei has dismissed around 60,000 public employees and has plans for even more cuts. He has privatized state-owned companies and advocates for complete free import, which is resulting in the closure and bankruptcy of small, medium, and even large businesses. It's a true paradise for free market principles.
Es el paraíso de lo que es el libre mercado. Javier Milei dice...
Javier Milei claims that social rights are insignificant. According to him, everything can be turned into a business. Everything should be a business.
Factible de ser un negocio. Todo debe ser negocio.
Everything can potentially become a source of wealth and immediate profit. There is no moral standard to consider. This is where Argentina has ended up.
A eso ha llevado Argentina. Más de la mitad de los hogares argentinos hoy día.
Currently, more than half of Argentine households allocate over 45% of their income to pay off debts. Middle-class Argentines are struggling to maintain a lifestyle that was already poor, and many are dipping into their savings just to get by.
Durante este año, un poco las formas de vida, que ya eran malas, pero mantenerla incluso, le ha significado echar mano de sus ahorros, y ya eso también se está terminando.
But those savings are running out too. With a fervent anti-communist stance, Milei has criticized the People's Republic of China, insisting he won't engage in negotiations with them.
Y dijo que por ningún motivo entraría en negociaciones con China, pero se ha casado los dedos en la puerta.
He has caught his fingers in the door. Now he's reaching out to the Chinese to see if he can start some economic negotiations because he is in a tight spot. The situation has him so overwhelmed that nearly all the money he collects goes towards paying off the external debt.
De tal manera tomado que prácticamente todo lo que se recauda va a pagar la deuda externa.
There will be leftover resources for social programs that are nearly non-existent because everything has been erased. For a long time, the Argentine people have lacked their own way forward. There has been deception and confusion. Negotiations have taken place with North American imperialism, Western Europe, and the collective West. Political leadership consistently seems to lead in that direction. Yet there are many indigenous communities.
Políticas estatales terminan en esa dirección. Sin embargo, hay una cantidad de pueblos originarios, ¿no? Hay trabajadores que son muchísimos.
There are numerous workers, especially today, who are seeking a way out. Undoubtedly, this year serves as a moment for reflection. We hope that the introspection of the Argentine people
de los argentinos
will guide them toward a path of liberation and away from this military government. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. Argentina es uno de los países marcantes.
Argentina stands out as a significant player on the international stage. Not just in South America or Latin America, the country boasts a wealth of natural resources, including minerals, agricultural products, and livestock. With a population of around 46 million, it is also quite populous. However, for a long time, Argentina has experienced a series of governments that seem to compete in their ineffectiveness. The current administration, led by Javier Milei, appears to be the tipping point.
Cuando el gobierno que tenemos hoy día de Milei ya pareciera ser que es la gota que rebasó el vaso.
What is happening in Argentina? Why are the Argentine people not reacting? What is the current economic, political, and social reality? What alternatives exist, and how can this situation be overcome? To discuss these pressing issues, we have a special guest from Argentina today.
Invitado de primera, especial, desde Argentina, estamos con...
Joining us is Luis Grestien, a journalist and deputy director of the newspaper Pagina 12. During the military dictatorship of Argentina, he was part of the Montonero organization, which actively resisted the regime. This involvement led him to exile after several members of his family, including his three brothers and father, were forcibly disappeared. Luis, it's a pleasure to have you here, sending you a warm virtual hug and greetings.
Y nada, un saludo para ti. Bueno, muchas gracias por el llamado.
Well, thank you for having me. It's also a pleasure to talk to you.
Luis, a un año prácticamente de la elección,
Louise, with almost a year since Javier Milei was elected president, what does the current situation look like in terms of the hopes people had? They voted for him as a reaction to issues that weren't being resolved. What's happening among the people? How is the economy today? Is there any movement or activity? Do we see a way forward?
Hay movilización, no la hay. Se ve salida.
Se va viendo la salida muy, muy, muy de a poco, como...
The way out for the people of Argentina is becoming clearer, albeit slowly. I believe a significant mistake which leftist policies or popular movements should take note of is the danger of making promises that cannot be fulfilled. This was somewhat the case with the previous government, which created high expectations but failed to meet them, even while facing three overlapping crises, a pandemic, a severe drought that cost the country $20 billion in revenue, and a heavy legacy of substantial debt with the IMF that was poorly negotiated. The negotiations lacked vigor, leaving Argentina heavily tied to the IMF's policies, which typically involve austerity measures that tend to drive inflation. In that context, despite these challenges, the candidate from the ruling party performed quite well in the elections, even though he ultimately lost. Meanwhile, Javier Milei emerged victorious, legally supported and financed by major corporations. It's important to remember that running a presidential campaign is not without significant costs. Milei didn't even have a party backing him, partly due to his media management. At that time, he was a very effective media figure. However, expectations are steadily declining. I believe that the popular support he had is slipping away. While he still holds a certain reputation, the polls have shifted significantly, showing a much larger portion of society disapproving of him and his policies. This group represents the segment of society that still has some expectations.
Luis, for instance, there have been numerous protests, actions taken by retirees, public employees, and even people from rural areas marching into the cities. The protesters have done various things, but there seems to be a lack of coordination within the social sphere.
Dentro del mundo social.
It's evident that there is a sense of anger and demand, but it appears to be scattered, at least from this perspective.
Pero disperso, por lo menos como se observa desde acá. En parte sí, digamos, yo lo que diría que más que la falta de articulación.
Partially, yes. What I would say is that it's less about a lack of coordination and more about the absence of an alternative political project that can connect at that level. You might be referring to this when you mentioned the lack of coordination. The reality is that there have been significant mobilizations when he took steps regarding human rights policies. There was a very, very large mass mobilization. Later, when he proposed labor flexibility, there was another large mobilization from the General Confederation of Labor and the labor movement. But these protests mainly involved sectors that have voted against the government. This began to change when retirees started to mobilize.
Cuando se empiezan a movilizar los jubilados.
Here we will stay with the retirees and then we'll continue after a short break. Thank you very much. Let's take a break.
Vamos a una pausa. Estamos de vuelta con Luis Grustein.
Well, we're back with Luis Grustein. Luis, you were mentioning some social groups that are currently mobilizing, like the retirees and the sectors of the General Confederation of Labor, right?
Los jubilados, los sectores de la CGT, ¿no?
What I wanted to share is that three key factors changed the landscape and began to impact Milei's voter support. First, there was a significant rise in fares, particularly in transportation, which is skyrocketed by 300%, 400%, and even 500%. Other fees, like gas and electricity, saw increases of up to 8,000%, and rents surged dramatically as well. Secondly, the biggest losers in this situation have been pensioners and retirees who face repression when they try to mobilize. Finally, the straw that broke the camel's back was the cuts to public universities. This issue resonates deeply and widely within society, leading to a massive mobilization that included many who had previously supported him. This is the voter base that Milei is losing, and it marks the beginning of a rapidly accelerating decline in his support.
El respaldo cada vez más acelerado, ¿no? Sí, sí, hay un proceso, digamos, de pérdida en el voto, pero...
Yes, there is a process of loss in voting, but as I listened to you, I was thinking about the way forward. The solution may be long-term, with the legislative elections in 2025 and the presidential elections in 2027 on the horizon. However, it's crucial to pay attention to what happens in between. From here, we're all very aware of the people's reactions, especially considering the increasing levels of poverty and repression. Even the Pope has pointed out that Milei spends more billions on repression than on addressing social demands.
Milei gasta más billones en represión que en solucionar las demandas sociales.
Sí, pero bueno, es un proceso que tiene que ver con los tiempos.
It's a process that relates to timing, the expectations that were built and the hopes that were raised, all tied to the earlier discussions we had. As society becomes more active and the people mobilize, especially when sectors that once supported Milei start to shift, we also see movements emerging within the opposition. The group best positioned to offer an alternative to Milei's extreme liberalism, which is harming the country, is Union para la Patria. This coalition, which includes Peronism and its allies, represents a new wave of Peronism through Kirchnerism. Notably, the governor of Buenos Aires province is gaining significant power. He oversees 40% of the population and has won all three elections where Milei was victorious nationally. While Milei was winning at the national level, Axel Kicillof, the governor of Buenos Aires, was securing victories in the most populous province in the country. A potential alternative to the systematic destruction being carried out by Milei is starting to emerge. Another important question is how much support he will receive from the so-called Red Circle, which refers to the group of major business leaders, corporations, concentrated capital, finance and industry. While he has shown some positive signals at the macroeconomic level, most indicators are negative. For instance, consumption has plummeted significantly and tax revenues has dropped considerably, making it difficult for him to maintain a zero deficit, a figure he takes great pride in. Inflation has been reduced to the level it was when he took office. Upon assuming his position, he implemented a 130% devaluation, which caused inflation to spike by 30% in just 1 month. However, he managed to bring it down to 3.5%, which is where it stood in November of last year.
That is indeed a crucial internal factor. But let's shift our focus to the external aspects. This situation unfolds within a very specific international context, and it's clear that Milei has made a choice that aligns Argentina with that stance. He has fully aligned himself with the collective West, Israeli Zionism, and the United States, placing us on the brink of what could be a global conflict. How does this factor influence the way reactionary forces, the IMF and others, support Milei's government? In Latin America, the divide is quite clear. You're either with the gringos or against them.
Un poco, digamos, el gobierno de Milei, porque en América Latina es muy claro. O estamos con los gringos, estamos contra ellos.
Totalmente. Y yo creo que, bueno, sería un poco más largo también de explicar, pero...
Absolutely. It takes a bit longer to explain, but the decline of the United States and its unipolar dominance is leading to odd situations like the one with Milei in Argentina or in Brazil. Milei's international stance, in my opinion, doesn't even truly benefit from the extreme alignment with the United States. It contradicts Argentina's historical foreign policy, putting us at odds with nearly all the countries that supported Argentina during the Malvinas issue. It's a position that simply doesn't make sense. However, this is part of the broader trend of extremism, particularly in Milei's economic and social policies. Just imagine, he had food stockpiled from the previous government and refused to distribute it to the popular soup kitchens. These soup kitchens have seen a rise in demand, and yet this individual chose to keep the food hidden instead of sharing it. There are numerous situations where private health insurance costs have skyrocketed and the middle class is suffering significantly. One of the first sacrifices made under this government, which many likely supported, was the abandonment of private health insurance, forcing people to rely on public hospitals. However, these public facilities are overwhelmed and underfunded. This paints a truly tragic picture of what Argentina is experiencing right now. It can only be described as a tragedy. I believe people are more focused on finding ways to survive rather than contemplating political solutions. At some point, this situation will either explode or lead to the country's collapse. It seems that the current approach isn't working either, benefiting only a small sector of concentrated capital. There's a gradual shift towards what could be termed a libertarian policy, moving towards a classic neoliberal stance represented by Mauricio Macri.
Absolutely. You are right, but it's undeniable that while he was elected by a significant number of people, he now primarily represents minority groups. We can also see the opposition and the struggles that people are facing, especially in the middle class. Many in the middle class have had to dip into their savings just to maintain a certain standard of living. It's a bigger challenge.
Es una complicación mayor. Muchos sectores de medios pasaron a la pobreza y muchos sectores de la pobreza.
Many middle-class sectors have fallen into poverty, and a significant number of those already in poverty have slipped below the extreme poverty line. In other words, there are many people struggling to afford food. Since Milei took office, nearly 10,000 businesses have closed in just 8 or 9 months. This impacts the middle class and small business owners, pushing them directly into poverty or a very low middle class. The speed and trauma of this social shift have been so intense that the immediate response is just survival. The next step will likely involve seeking ways to improve their situation. We're currently in a transitional phase. Since Milei's arrival, the number of people living in poverty has increased by 7 million, pushing them below the poverty line. This is an astonishing number of individuals experiencing a decline in their quality of life and consumption habits, leading to real hardship. The country is at this moment in a state of devastation.
Absolutely,
Luis. That's right. Well, time is quite short. We're approaching the end. The challenges facing Argentina and its people are evident. It's not an easy situation, especially with the ongoing process of recolonization in Latin America by the Americans, who are essentially looking for their backyard. I hope we will have another chance for dialogue. I thank you for being here with us on Black and White.
I want to thank you all so much for the call. I really appreciate it.
A warm hug for you and the people of Argentina.
Thank you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
President-elect Donald Trump has selected former White House aide Brooke Rollins to lead the Department of Agriculture. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. President-elect Donald Trump said on Saturday, 23rd of November, that he will nominate former White House aide Brooke Rollins to be his agriculture secretary, the last of his picks to lead executive agencies and another choice from within his established circle of advisors and allies. The nomination must be confirmed by the U.S. Senate, which will be controlled by Republicans when Donald Trump takes office on 20th of January 2025. Brooke Rollins would succeed Tom Vilsack, President Biden's agriculture secretary, who oversees the sprawling agency that controls policies, regulations, and aid programs relating to farming, forestry, ranching, food quality, and nutrition. Brooke Rollins, who graduated from Texas A&M University with degrees in agricultural development, is a longtime Donald Trump associate who served as his former domestic policy chief. She is president and chief executive officer of the America First Policy Institute, a group helping to lay the groundwork for a second Trump administration. Brooke Rollins, 52 years old, previously served as an aide to former Texas Governor Rick Perry and ran a think tank, the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Brooke Rollins's pick completes Donald Trump's selection of the heads of executive branch departments just 2.5 weeks after the former president won the White House once again. Several other picks that are traditionally cabinet level remain, including U.S. Trade Representative and head of the Small Business Administration. Donald Trump didn't offer many specifics about his agriculture policies during the election campaign, but farmers could be affected if it carries out his pledge to impose widespread tariffs. During the first Trump administration, countries like China responded to Trump's tariffs by imposing retaliatory tariffs on U.S. exports, like corn and soybeans, routinely sold overseas. Donald Trump countered by offering massive multi-billion dollar aid to farmers to help them weather the trade war. The U.S. Agricultural Agency also set standards for school meals within the United States. Robert Kennedy Jr., Donald Trump's nominee to lead the Department of Health and Human Services, has vowed to strip ultra-processed foods from school lunches and to stop allowing Supplement Nutrition Assistance Program beneficiaries from using food stamps to buy soda, candy, or other so-called junk foods. But it would be the U.S. Department of Agriculture, not the Health and Human Services, that would be responsible for enacting those changes. In addition, Health and Human Services and the U.S. Department of Agriculture will work together to finalize the 2025-2030 edition of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. They are due late next year, with guidance for healthy diets and standards for federal nutrition programs. The national broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story and tells us more. President-elect Donald Trump has selected former White House aide Brooke Rollins to lead the Department of Agriculture in his second administration. And here are some things to know about Trump's choice and the agency that Brooke Rollins would lead if she is confirmed by the U.S. Senate. Brooke Rollins, 52 years old, graduated from Texas A&M University with an undergraduate degree in agricultural development before completing law school at the University of Texas. She served as domestic policy chief during Donald Trump's first term in office, a portfolio that included agricultural policy. After leaving the White House, she became president and chief executive officer of the America First Policy Institute, a group which helped to lay the groundwork for a second Trump administration. Over the years, Brooke Rollins has forged a strong enough relationship with Donald Trump, who has prized proven loyalty in his cabinet and top advisor picks, that she was among the people floated as a potential White House chief of staff. However, that job went to Susie Wiles, Donald Trump's co-campaign manager. Brooke Rollins has described her boss, Donald Trump, as an amazing boss.
Hello and welcome to the Cradle News Roundup, your one-stop shop for all news West Asia. My name is Esteban Carrillo. I'm the head of news for the Cradle. And as usual, I'm joined by my colleagues, content creator and writer for the Cradle, Karim Shami. And back with us after a few weeks off, a columnist and editor for the Cradle, Sharmeen Narwani. So we are speaking today. The Israeli attacks against Lebap significantly intensified over recent days, targeting residential areas in Beirut, destroying towns in the south of Lebanon, destroying villages and towns in the east, hitting all the way to the north, just from north to south. But at the same time, Hezbollah attacks have also intensified in Israel, in Tel Aviv. Just a few hours ago, a Hezbollah missile made a direct impact in Tel Aviv. Rocket barrages, drone swarms are being nonstop in the north, in Haifa, in Tel Aviv, in the vicinity of Tel Aviv, targeting military sites, sensitive sites all across. In the south of Lebanon, fighting has been as intense as we have seen at any point. During this war, the Israeli army is trying to push forward. Hezbollah forces are hand heavy losses. And as all of this is happening, the U.S. Special Envoy for the region, Amos Hochstein, is, as we are recording this, in Beirut, meeting with Lebanese officials. Before his trip, the State Department said that Washington is determined to reach a ceasefire deal for Lebanon. Hochstein, you know, just before I wrap up this intro right now, just want to point out that before he left for Beirut, Hochstein actually delayed his trip. He delayed his trip deliberately and to try to exert pressure against Beirut, asking them, we need clarifications on your stance on the ceasefire. right? And when we talk about the ceasefire, we only need to look at Gaza. We only need to look at the genocide in Gaza to understand where the efforts for a ceasefire really stand, right, when it comes from U.S. officials. But that's kind of the reality on the ground right now. As I said, Lebanon is getting hit very strongly. Israel not getting away clean either. So, you know, what is next and what is, you know, what is happening on the ground, really?
In the past 3 days, Israel intensified their attacks in Lebanon, especially in the south, in the towns of Nabatieh and Antyr. Nabatieh alone had, in the past 48 hours, more than 150 airstrikes. And the area is somehow completely destroyed. And also they destroyed the roads that lead to Tayr Sur. And of course, in the Bekaa area and the Bekaa Valley, there's also devastation. And what happened recently in the past also 3 days in Beirut, usually Israel gives warnings before they strike Beirut. Yesterday was the first time they striked a residential area in Dahiya, which still has inhabitants because it's far from Hartahrik and other places, and they downed a building. And I had a personal experience. Israel 2 days ago bombed Marilyas. If our viewers saw the strike, this was very close to my house. It was around 50 meters away from my house. Of course, we heard the missiles before they hit, and there were four explosions. And so it was terrifying because your enemy is Israel. You don't know where they're going to hit.
What's happened the last few days in Beirut is essentially Israel striking non-Shia neighborhoods. I mean, that's essentially what's different. Without warning, with spurious claims about Hezbollah official being here or there.
Yeah. Is the Gaza
in the case of the killing of Mohammed Afif, who was the official Hezbollah spokesman? He was in a Christian part of town, actually a few hundred meters from where I live, and then. You know, your area, Karim, is mixed, and they're targeting these areas very slyly. And I don't think anyone's trying to hide at this point, because analysts have rushed to point out that Israel's just trying to gain some cards, psychological though they may be, to push Lebanese parties and populations to support a ceasefire no matter what the terms are. You know, it's pretty transparent for us that that's what Israel's trying to do. You know, it's not consistently one neighborhood. It's just a few here and there. But doing missile-level damage in these neighborhoods that, you know, that felt relatively safe. Because let's be honest, if, you know, we had the Dahiya Doctrine in, like, 2006, this is the Shia doctrine, okay? Israel is hitting in the south of Lebanon, in the Beirut suburbs, in Bekaa. They're targeting Shia. And they are targeting, sort of on the periphery, Shia displaced persons in other neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. But as a warning to create, and not just as a warning, to create civil strife, you know?
Yes.
So if Shia have moved into Christian neighborhoods happily with residents welcoming them, weeks and weeks later, these same residents are questioning whether these people should even be in their neighborhoods because that they now risk their building being. There's a lot of panic in certain political groups in Lebanon, and even sort of chattering civilians about these escalations. And, you know, it's really important to not miss seeing the forest for the trees. Because in terms of, you know, I've always called this a PR war for Israel, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not good for their public relations, but they strike things to get maximum impact among populations, news viewers and readers and governments around the world, right? But are they attaining any of their strategic goals? I mean, there's not a single one they've attained since the beginning, since October 7th, 2023. And then, you know, again, let's, you know, rewind and go back to why they decided to launch a land invasion of Lebanon. It was because they said their ostensibly their war goal was to get Israeli settlers back into the northern settlements. And that has not happened. The opposite has happened. Not only are most of these settlements completely empty right now, and Hezbollah has managed to penetrate even deeper into the north, so even more settlements have emptied out. But now you have major cities in Haifa, in Tiberias, in Tel Aviv, and the areas, the Gush Dan area, you know, the triangle around Tel Aviv. Bless you, Karim. Last night, Hezbollah did a very successful hit on Ramat Gan, which is also, on the outskirts of Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
Something we hadn't seen before, you know, bring the war to their cities and the way Israel's trying to bring the war to Beirut. And the thing is, these people are living, these Israelis now in the major cities and towns outside the northern settlements are now living in constant fear with sirens, you know, running their daily lives. You know, all normalcy has come to a stop because now they're seeing fires. They're seeing buildings being hit, you know, within the Ramat Gan strike that Hezbollah did last night. You had all glass, all windows within a 1 kilometer distance shattered. I mean, it reminds us of here what we experienced in Lebanon during the Beirut port explosion. You know, there was glass everywhere in the streets, and they remained for weeks and weeks, if in some cases not months. So, Israel strategically, Israel's kind of run out of targets, right? In the initial days and weeks of their escalation in Lebanon, you could see clear strategic targets. Okay, in their mind, they believe to take out the entire leadership of Hezbollah, from the secretary general down to the military commanders, etc., would buy them a strategic victory. It didn't, right? Hezbollah continued to launch missiles, continued to escalate, according to how Israel escalated in Lebanon. This is just a shit show for Israel. They're not achieving anything. And, you know, there is the law of diminishing returns, right? So, you know, in essence, Israel's doing more, but achieving less strategically, okay? In the court of public opinion, it's losing even more. You know, a lot more people are paying attention to Lebanon now suddenly. But importantly, it's war goals, getting settlers back to the north, getting hostages back in Gaza. You know, by escalating Gaza, remember in the first months, there were negotiations and there were temporary ceasefire deals, right, in which Israel got back over 100 of the captives, right? Then it escalated for different reasons, unstated war goals, which was making Gaza uninhabitable, forcing Palestinians out of Gaza, you know, annexing Gaza, building beachfront properties, etc. All unstated goals. Eradicating Hamas, that has not happened in over a year. Eradicating Hezbollah by going for its leadership, that has not happened. So what is, you know, if anything, Israel's major cities, towns, infrastructure, military bases are getting decimated. They're getting hit with even more frequency with Hezbollah hitting deeper into Israeli territory.
Right now, just to go back to the ceasefire talks, right, because that's the thing right now. Hochstein is in Beirut.
Yeah.
Lebanese officials have been very clear. Lebanese officials were not exactly always have the interest of the Lebanese people at the front of their mind, but they have been very clear in saying we are negotiating under constant escalation. Right. And this is what Israel said themselves too. Like Netanyahu said something to that regard as well. Like, if we want to keep freedom of attacks, right, of movement in Lebanese airspace, in the Lebanese territory, even if we sign a ceasefire. And you had Benny Gantz, right, this guy who was by the White House presented as the moderate Israeli leader. A couple of days ago, he comes out with this video saying that the south of Lebanon needs to be turn into something like Area A in the West Bank, right, where the Israeli army has the ability to just come in and out, continue attacks, essentially annex the south of Lebanon. You have the Jerusalem Post, you know, with headline after headline saying actually southern Lebanon is more like northern Israel. Is Lebanon part of the promised land that is for that was promised to the Jewish people, etc.? This the consent is being formed for the occupation of South Lebanon. And I think, you know, right now when you see someone like Amos Hochstein, who is on like who knows